Hello, Jay. Describe your debut novel, The Standard Grand, and tell us something about its birthing, the story of the story.
The Standard Grand is about a defunct Borscht Belt resort in the Catskill Mountains of New York, and the main character of the story finds herself there. She sort of bumbles there. Her name is Specialist Antebellum Smith, and she goes AWOL. She leaves an abusive husband and her post at Fort Leonard Wood in the Ozarks, and she lives on the lam. She sleeps homeless in Central Park for a time, and there she has a run-in with the proprietor of the Standard Grand, and he takes her on up to this ramshackle resort that he has converted into a kind of halfway house for homeless vets. And in the meantime, there's a whole subplot about a Houston-based multinational corporation that is trying to get its hands on the Standard, which sits pretty over the Marcellus Shale formation. And as the story of the story goes, it was inspired largely by my former sister-in-law, my youngest brother's first wife. She was an Army trucker, and she deployed to Iraq during the surge. She was there. I remember her having a 15-month deployment, I think, and it was impossibly hard on their relationship. And at some point during that relationship, she had an affair with a soldier there in Iraq, and it kind of precipitated a slow decline of the relationship between my sister-in-law and my brother. And when she got back stateside, she sort of cut off all contact with him. And it was in that absence of information where we were kind of scrambling for what was happening. We didn't know, even if she'd come back, because she kind of cut off some ties before returning stateside. Wow. And it was in that absence of information that my imagination just started to work. And 5 years later, this novel kind of came to be, and the main character now bears very little actual resemblance to my sister-in-law other than her military job and a home state. She's a Floridian.
Are you a veteran yourself?
I am not, no. I have veteran friends, and I grew up working class, fatherless, and my mom has worked at a 7-Eleven for going on 30 years now. She's clerked there partly because their health insurance was decent, and she had three young boys to raise, and we were always breaking something or other. So she stayed with 7-Eleven so long because their health insurance was decent. And there were a number of times in my early adulthood, two serious times where I considered joining the military. One was right after September 11th, and one was a little bit later after I'd finished a graduate degree and was kind of floating around, and got as far as going to the recruitment office and signing up for the ASVAB.
What turned you around?
Well, partly, and I would even say mostly what turned me around was what I understood as just the absolute desperation of the recruitment officer. They were, and the officer was voracious. After I showed some interest, he just hounded me constantly. And there was something about that hard sell insistence that really turned me off. And at the same time, we had just started talk of the invasion of Iraq. And I felt I was very kind of, you know, paying close attention to the news the whole time. And after September 11th, I felt like the invasion of Afghanistan was merited and justified. But when talk turned to Iraq, I just turned off. I thought it was outrageous. And I can remember long conversations with one of my younger brothers, Dane, my middle brother, who was more for the invasion. And I just couldn't stomach it. And I wanted nothing to do with it. So instead instead of joining the Army, I moved to New York City.
Well, your debut novel doesn't read as a debut. It's gaining a lot of attention, and congratulations on that. I saw it was on the Indie Bounds Indie Next list, the Library Journal's Spring 2017 Debut Novels, Great First Acts, named New and Noteworthy by Poets and Writers. So how's that feeling?
You know, it feels good. I guess the reality of the situation is, though, that making those lists don't necessarily translate into people buying the book. And I think
so
that
starving
sales,
artist is true.
Right. I think the sales of the thing have been a little bit disappointing for St. Martin's. So, you know, it's wonderful to have outlets like yours to nudge things along, because it's really hard to gain traction for a novel to gain any
a new name, you know,
a new name. And in the news, in the kind of climate of political news, I think the readers have turned a little bit away from books to kind of keep abreast of all that's going on in Washington and elsewhere. So I think it's just hard to draw readers into novels at this point. But hopefully, I think, you know, the quality is good enough that it will find its audience.
Actually, your novel has gotten praise for not ignoring or exploiting gender, race, trauma, class, or war. Maybe those readers need to crack the cover open and realize that there may be something there to identify with after all. Was that a conscious effort on your part? I mean, for one thing, we don't have a lot in literature about women veterans.
Incredibly conscious. I wanted to address all the big questions and all the big concerns that we face as a modern culture. And I wanted to cram all those things into the book, and I wanted to do it kind of in a way that shatters some stereotypes. I'm a man in middle age now, and I was raised by two women, and so I think I have a perspective that afforded me a chance to get more closely inside the mind and inner workings of a woman protagonist. And, you know, I did want to address a lot of the big questions, and it wasn't easy. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why it took me so long to finish this book. I had to do tons and tons of research. I tried to read everything that I could and talk to people and try to fit that into the book in an artful way, in a way that didn't read like research, which is the tricky part.
Well, you're married to a writer, too. I'm wondering, you know, when you have the courage, because I think it takes a lot of guts to write as if from a different gender, did you have your wife read it and give you a critique of, wait a minute, a woman wouldn't think this way, wouldn't talk this way?
Yes. My wife, Thisbe Nissen, she's a wonderful writer and a wonderful novelist, and she's a full-time faculty member at Western Michigan. And she was an encouragement and an inspiration. She, too, while I was working on this novel for years, she was working on her forthcoming novel for years. And we are one another's first readers. And, you know, she's also my best friend. I talk to her about everything. Although the funny thing is that one dark spot, one blind spot in our relationship is we don't really actively talk about the things that we're working on, the things that we're writing on. So,
are you one of those writers who thinks it jinxes your work if you talk about it too much?
I'm not superstitious about it. I feel like words are a kind of currency, and I feel like I only have so many in a given day. And if I spend them on talking or explaining, or conducting an interview, then I don't have as much to write about. And I think while a novel is gaining momentum, so much of it is just kind of up in the air and you don't really know where it's going. And I think I don't really have the confidence oftentimes to talk specifically about it until it starts to take real formative shape. And then I get to talk about it. But Thisbe and I, you know, swap writing all the time, and she would call me on mistakes, of course. And two, I had the wonderful benefit of working with a pair of other terrific, astute, smart, creative women. My agent, Jen Carlson, was a reader all throughout the thing, and she was very instrumental. And then she landed me with my editor, Elizabeth Disregard at St. Martin's, and then she and I went through again. So I had a kind of a battery of women who ran me through the ringer, making sure that I was getting things right. But for the most part, I think I did.
You started out writing more as a marathon runner, didn't you? You were inspired by a marathon writer, but then it turned into something else. I read somewhere that you talked about how your running influenced your writing.
Yes. In the very early going, in the very early drafting of this novel had nothing to do with veterans. It had nothing to do with, you know, a Houston company. It started off as, you know, it had nothing to do with my former sister-in-law. It started off as inspired by a woman who in late middle age started running. She was an ultra marathoner. She had a frontal lobectomy to help cure her epilepsy, and the surgery produced some quirk of her conception of time. And so it would allowed her to kind of just run for long distances. And she was an ultra marathoner who did 100-mile races. And I was jogging at the time. I'd started jogging, and I tried to reimagine this woman in the Catskills, where poor Thisbe and I lived for a period when this novel was getting underway. And she happened into a Borscht Belt resort. They're all around up there in the Catskills, and they're wonderful places. And Thisbe and I were driving all around and seeing these things. So they just started working their way into what I was working on at the time. And then a Vietnam vet kind of worked his way into the story, and I was reading news stories about how there were a couple of these Borscht Belt resorts that were converted into halfway houses, and one of the mayors of New York City tried to get one of these big empty resorts into, I think, a 1,000-bed homeless shelter for people in New York City, but it was turned down by the local residents. And so I was imagining all this and reading all these stories and working on it, and when I set it there in the Catskills, I needed some veterans. And that's when my sister-in-law, her influence kind of came into the story, and I started working on a character inspired by her, and then she just took over. And all the time I was running and jogging myself, so there's some running in the story, and, you know, I'm a big advocate of long walks and jogging and the kind of downtime that's, I think, necessary for people engaged in creative endeavors. I think that's one of the hardest parts about writing is trying to think about the leisure time while not actively writing as every bit as important to the active writing time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I wonder, too, if there's something similar in the discipline of getting out there to run every day and sitting down to that blank page every day.
Yes, I think absolutely. And I think my approach to both is very blue collar, you know, and I think that's the inspiration of my mom, who got up every morning and, you know, went to 7-Eleven to work, even though she didn't like the job. Mm-hmm. And I think I try to treat writing in the same way. I don't necessarily love to sit down at the desk and write. I don't enjoy it, but I would say it's one of the most satisfying things that I do. It kind of engages the most of me in a way that feels like hard work, but maybe the best kind of work that I'm capable of.
When you put this novel together, there's a lot of conflicts, a lot of friction, as any novel would have. You put big oil and the big corporation as something of the shadow.
You know, while I was working on this, there was the big open-ended question of whether or not Governor Cuomo was going to open up the Marcellus Shale to horizontal hydrofracking. While I was working on the novel, the question had not been resolved. So I was thinking partly about that and thinking about how to get larger kind of political issues into the novel without forcing them there.
Yeah.
And how I might make it feel natural rather than have the novel just kind of be small and local. I wanted it to have a larger, more global feel. And I guess my ambitions for this were big. And I think, as you intimated earlier, you know, it doesn't read like a first novel. And that's because it's not. You know, I think it's very much a mid-career novel. You know, I'd finished and tried to publish three earlier ones and failed each time. Although each time I think I got a little closer to publishing one. And so this
one
is
more typical than not, I think.
It is. Unfortunately, it's just so hard to publish a novel. And I've found that the people who wind up doing it are the ones who just don't give up for whatever
exactly.
reason.
Persistence, yeah.
Or madness.
yes.
You know, I mean, I think at points I was definitely driven crazy by the endless rejection.
Yeah.
But every time I afterwards, after the heartbreak of, you know, of having a novel rejected by editors, I somehow managed to gather myself and start work on a new one. So, you know, so when I was working on this notion of, you know, the Houston multinational corporation, I was thinking in larger cultural and almost geopolitical terms. And then at some point, the novel just kind of coalesced, and it started to feel, and I tried not to play this issue too heavy-handedly, but it started to feel like the story and the novel almost became a kind of parable of the invasion of Iraq, that you had this kind of Houston-based corporation coming in and wanting to lay claim to oil reserves or gas reserves in this case. So that was involved.
Do you think we glorify war too much? Because I had this sense from your story, you have someone who deserted, and maybe that it's easier to desert than we may think.
I think we do. I don't want to speak, you know, kind of out of school. I think here in this country, we do glorify war. You know, I grew up playing guns, you know, on a daily basis with my friends,
right, yeah.
With my family. We spent Easters at a gun club. We would go and, you know, shoot pistols and rifles and shotguns. You know, we are a gun-obsessed culture, and I think we do glorify war. And I think part of I think what's hard for a writer like me and a novel like mine, and I know that I'm not alone, but that people who try to present war in all of its complexity, they're resisted. And I think partly because it's not simple. The message that I'm trying to convey, the characters that I'm trying to bring to life, they're complicated. They're messy. They're ugly. I think it makes for difficult reading, demanding reading. The emotional wringer that I think a reader is put through while reading my novel is hard. And so I think the audience for it isn't as big, but I think that the voice is necessary, you know, and there are a lot of other writers and artists, movie makers out there working to complicate some of these stories.
Do you see writing as activism? Is that what it is for you in some ways?
For me, it is. I definitely. I'm not. I learned some time ago, and maybe it's just in my middle age, I'm no longer much of a social person. I don't feel comfortable in crowds. I feel much more capable when I'm at my desk trying to tell stories and to convey information. I feel like I'll reach far more people that way. But I do think it's necessary to venture out into the world now that this novel is done. You know, I'm having to go out and do readings and things, and I feel myself opening up a little more again after having hunkered down for such a long time.
I read somewhere that you likened Moby Dick to our current administration. I found that interesting. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I think I am not a Trump fan at all. I mean, I think he's a con man, and I do think that there is some complexity to him that the mainstream media doesn't or has refused to acknowledge. But it's part of how I think he's caricatured himself.
How did you see him in this book, Moby Dick? Again, I read somewhere in some interview that you talked about that it was a difficult book for you to read, but you listened to it and then you saw that similarity.
Yes. Well, you know, I think the easy analogy, as I guess I've mentioned elsewhere, is President Trump is something of a Captain Ahab, mm-hmm. You know, and he's at the helm and he's, you know, driving the ship of state and he has some very strong ideas, you know, and whether or not his motivations are good or just, I don't really think so. But I don't think that Trump is much of the Ahab. I think that's the easy analogy. I think he's more like the white whale. He's more Moby Dick. And I think the white male voter is Ahab. And I think there's a lot of resentment driving our politics right now. And I think it doesn't make for good decisions. I don't think it makes for thoughtful policies. And I think it just leads to intransigence and hopefully it doesn't lead to the sinking of the ship. Yeah, and, you know, I know plenty of people have their qualms with Obama, but just the kind of contrast of somebody like No Drama Obama versus Donald Trump, who is all drama. I mean, it's a circus. And you know, whether or not all of the negative attention is based in fact is somewhat debatable. But I mean, you can't argue against the discrepancy of just drama that surrounds this administration and how much it's hampering any kind of progress whatsoever.
And then you have some fun cameo appearances, the names that people would recognize in your book, Sammy Davis Jr. and Senator Al Franken.
Yes, yeah. So there are two real-world characters that make their way into the novel. And Sammy Davis Jr. is almost like, I feel like he's the soul of this novel to some degree. But it was the Al Franken character, and Al Franken appears in a kind of transcript of a subcommittee report late in the novel. And when I was trying to capture Franken's voice, I was reading all of these transcripts. You can just go to the various Senate websites, and most of the transcripts, if they're not classified or behind closed doors, they're available, so you can read them. And a lot of them are very entertaining. I mean, a lot of them read like plays. And as you might imagine, Al Franken is one of the most, if not the most engaging of our political figures. Mm-hmm. So I was reading these transcripts and just enjoying them a great deal. So trying to capture some of that in the novel and to bring in, again, more of a kind of political side, you know, the voice and viewpoint of our senators and actual leaders, and he was represented that way. And after the novel was bought by St. Martin's, they had to then go and send it to outside legal counsel to make sure that the representation of Senator Franken wasn't going to get them sued. And when they sent...
And they gave you the okay?
They not only gave the okay, the lawyer who they sent it to said, yeah, I don't see anything wrong with this, but is this fiction? He couldn't tell if it was an actual Senate report or not. He didn't know if it was an excerpt, that what they sent
him. Oh, excellent.
If it was an excerpt from nonfiction or from a novel. So I took that as a compliment.
As you should. You should send him a copy.
Well, so far he hasn't sued St. Martin, so...
Have you sent him a copy?
I have not.
Well, let's get on it, Jay.
Yeah.
So tell me about Catskill Studio for Writing. That's something you did before you moved to Battle Creek?
Yes. When Thisbe and I were there in Saugerties, we had two wonderful friends. We still have these friends, although they're not neighbors anymore. Nellie Reifler and Jonathan Dixon, and they're both wonderful writers, published books, and they had a house just a few miles from us. And so with the two of them, we all established this little writing retreat. And it was partly at our house and partly at Nellie and Jonathan's house. And Jonathan is also a chef in addition to being a writer. And so he prepared the gourmet meals for the students. And it lasted a handful of days. And the students kind of made their own accommodations. I think half of them stayed at a KOA campground just down the road. And it was just, it was a wonderful little kind of retreat there in the summertime in the Catskills. And we didn't do it. I think we only did it one time. It was exhausting. It was a ton of work.
Yeah.
But worthwhile.
So how did you come from New York to Battle Creek? What was that move for you?
Thisbe and I were in the Catskills, and I was working full-time at a nonprofit in New York City, and I was commuting down on Monday mornings and coming back Thursday afternoons. I had an apartment in Brooklyn, and then I rented a room from a friend in Brooklyn. And then after Thisbe and I got married, I spent weeknights with Thisbe's mom, who has an apartment in the city. And Thisbe, in the meantime, was commuting to Boston for a teaching job at Brandeis. And then after that expired, she was teaching at the New School. And so she was commuting down, and we just had these insane commutes. We decided that we wanted to try to have a baby. And when we did decide that, Thisbe started applying to teaching jobs any and everywhere. and we had a bit of a tough time at the beginning conceiving. And I think within hours, probably, of Thisbe being offered a full-time job at Western, all the stresses were kind of gone, and all of a sudden she was pregnant. And to accommodate us and to, I think, lure us out there, they made a part-time position for me. So I taught at Western for a number of years and was the advisor for Third Coast, the literary magazine there. But after my novel sold, I've stopped teaching and just focused on writing.
That's nice. So now you're in a farmhouse with, and we have this in common, chickens.
Yes. Yes. Well, we had chickens in New York. We had about 10. And when we drove out, I made a little chicken condo out of old vegetable crates in the back of a U-Haul trailer, an open U-Haul trailer.
So they were New Yorkers, too.
Yeah. So we drove our chickens clucking across halfway across the continent. I guess less than halfway.
And they all did okay?
They did fine, yeah. They travel well. I think we only have, that was almost 8 years ago now. Mm-hmm. I think we have two of that brood left. We have a 9-year-old hen and a couple of 8-year-old hens. So I guess we have three left.
Nice.
But we've
How many
we've
have you got now?
As of today, we have 15. I mean, as you know, they're pretty vulnerable creatures.
Do they free range?
Yes, yes. So I built a little run off one of our barns. So they have the coop in a corner of the barn with an open window, and we have ramps. And I built the run off of the corner of the barn, and we just go out in the morning and open the run door, and they're all waiting in the run to come out, and they, you know, conduct their days throughout the yard, and then come dusk, as you know. Mm-hmm. They return back home to roost. So we have problems with the hawks and things. Right now there's a fledgling hawk that's flying around, has been flying around for about a week, just harrying the chickens. So they're all a little bit
skittish. Have you ever had guinea hens?
We have not, but I think I saw. I've been watching the growth of yurkeet, and I'm attracted. I mean, I love the idea.
I tell you, so far she's promising. She's not big enough yet to free range. I keep them inside for a while until I think they're big enough and smart enough and heavy enough for the hawks not to carry them away. But I was driving a tractor around on my lawn mowing, and I thought, what is that screeching horrible sound? I thought I'd broken my tractor. It was the guinea hen.
Wow.
She was warning the other hens about this loud beast. So, and I thought, okay, this might work.
Yeah, yeah. They're supposed to be very territorial, too.
So
they can be like attack hens.
So I'll let you know if this works, if she can keep the predators away and warn the flock. So we'll see how that goes. All right, Jay. Well, it's been great fun talking with you, writing and chickens. So thank you for taking time today.
My pleasure, Zinta. Thank you.